And today he's going to tell us about the rank matrix recovery from Pauli measurements.
Thanks. So hi, everyone, and thanks for having me here. So the title of my talk is Universal Low Rank Matrix Recovery Using Pauli Measurements. And this is really connected with methods for quantum state tomography and compressed sensing. So let me briefly tell you the kind of thing that we're interested in. So this is quantum state tomography for large quantum systems where there's a large number of degrees of freedom. And so one wants a procedure where one can estimate the state of the system efficiently using fewer measurements. And the example that we've had in mind is really qubits. So you can imagine n qubits, and the Hilbert space dimension d is 2 to the n. And so the density matrix rho is a d by d matrix, so it has 4 to the n degrees of freedom. And and as an example of such a system, say in ion traps, now one can get as many as maybe 8 or 14 qubits in a single trap. So this is large enough that the density matrix really is a large object to estimate. A straightforward way of doing tomography is to simply measure Pauli matrices. And here I mean tensor products of single qubit Paulis. So there are d squared of them, and they form a complete orthogonal operator basis. And so by measuring their expectation values, you can then reconstruct the density matrix. And this is straightforward, but there's something interesting that happens. So if you consider a pure state, then this actually only has order d degrees of freedom rather than d squared. And it turns out that you can actually take advantage of this. So the general statement is that if rho is a rank r matrix, then you can reconstruct it by measuring a random set of order r times d Pauli matrices. And there's also a log d factor there. And this is what people talk about when they refer to compressed tomography, that in this situation where the density matrix has some structure, namely that it's low rank, then you can actually do the estimation using a number of measurements that only scales with the true number of degrees of freedom, order r times d, rather than the naive number of degrees of freedom, which is d squared. Okay? And so this was originally some work that is due to myself and a number of collaborators, and particularly David Gross in 2009. Okay. So let me state this a little bit more precisely, and then I'll show you what's new in this talk. So the precise statement that's shown in these papers is that, So apparently this is what I'm supposed to use to point at the screen. So the precise statement is that for any matrix rho of dimension d and rank r, then you choose a random set omega of Pauli matrices. And then with high probability, this set omega will allow you to reconstruct rho, okay? And the particular way you do it is that you measure the expectation values of the Pauli operators P in the set rho, and then you solve a convex program that reconstructs rho from these expectation values. And so this is convenient because you can solve this convex program in time polynomial in the number of variables, okay? So now what is new in this talk is to prove a stronger statement that takes these quantifiers in a different order. And this is what I mean when I talk about universal low rank matrix recovery. So in fact, we can prove a stronger statement where you take these quantifiers and put them at the top. So you first choose the random set omega of Pauli matrices and then fix it. And that set will actually be good simultaneously for all low rank states rho, okay? And so you say that this set omega is universal, that it's simultaneously good for all possible low rank states. And so this on its face is kind of interesting because it's saying that, in fact, to do tomography, you only need to measure this subset of Pauli observables, and you don't even need, in principle, the ability to measure the other ones. you could actually leave them out of your device if that would help you in any way. Usually it doesn't in practice, but you could. And so this is different from the earlier results, because with the earlier results, you sort of had this feeling that you're chasing around, you know, the problem, that for every low rank density matrix, a random set of Paulis will probably be good, but you could get unlucky. And it's just that, you know, you, most of the time it works. But here you really have a single set of these Paulis that works for all states rho. And so this is what this talk is about. And this is some work due to myself from last year. Okay? And so, you know, so conceptually, this has sort of an interesting geometric picture associated with it. These original results on matrix completion, they used something called the dual certificate for the analysis. And this really has to do with the behavior of this reconstruction problem in the neighborhood of the true state rho. So it's sort of a local analysis of the problem. Whereas this universal result is actually telling you something different. It's telling you some global property of the entire state space. And this global property is called the restricted isometry property, and I'll tell you what that is presently. But roughly speaking, it says that the whole state space can be embedded into a lower dimension. Sort of, so with small distortion, you can collapse the whole state space into dimension M, where M is roughly the rank times the dimension. Okay? And let me make this all a little bit more precise. This is the convex program that you use to reconstruct an estimate of the state rho. So here rho is the unknown density matrix, omega is the subset of Pauli operators. And this thing R of rho, R is the sampling operator, and it's the operator that returns the vector of Pauli expectation values for a given state rho, okay? So it's this vector of expectation values, trace of P times rho, for all P in the set omega. And so this corresponds to what we do in a real experiment, where we estimate these expectation values. And so we measure some vector B, which is approximately equal to R of rho up to statistical errors or experimental errors. So what this convex program does is it says that you minimize the trace of, so the trace norm of a matrix X, subject to this first constraint, which says that R of X has to agree approximately with the measured data, and the second constraint, which says that X has to be positive semi-definite. Okay? So this is sort of the recipe for how you do compressed tomography. And so this is the underlying geometric picture that we imagine that from our measurements we have this constraint R of X equals to B approximately. And this is the set of feasible solutions. So this defines a hyperplane in high dimensional space. Now, subject to that constraint, we're trying to minimize the trace norm of the matrix X. So we imagine that we're trying to find a point within this region, the trace norm ball. And I've drawn it like a diamond because that's what it looks like in the case of the L1 norm in two dimensions. But it's, you know, but the intuition is that it's actually kind of a spiky looking object. So it doesn't really look much like a sphere. It looks more like sort of like a polyhedron. And so this program will successfully reconstruct rho if it's the case that rho is the unique solution to the optimization problem. So that means that this hyperplane intersects the trace norm ball in a single point. Okay? And so there's sort of a hand-wavy explanation for why it works. So the first thing is that rho is a low rank state. So this means that it's on an exposed point of the trace norm ball. And it's exposed in the sense that most perturbations around the point rho will actually increase the trace norm because it's low rank. So this is one part of the picture. So rho already is in a position where it's fairly easy to hit it uniquely with this hyperplane. So the second part is simply the shape of the trace norm ball itself, which is kind of spiky, and it itself has many of these exposed points. So that's why the trace norm is special as compared to, say, the Frobenius norm. And then the last thing is that we chose this set of Pauli measurements at random. So the sampling operator R is random in some sense, and therefore the orientation of this hyperplane is sort of random. And so in many of these results, the way it works is that you argue that with high probability, this hyperplane is just going to fail to be aligned with the faces of the trace norm ball, and therefore it's going to have a unique intersection. Okay? And so it's not entirely that simple. You need some things to go right for this to happen. So the first thing is that the measurements you use have to be what are called incoherent. So this word incoherent in this context actually originated from applied mathematicians. And so for a long time, it never occurred to me that anyone could be confused, but it really has a completely different meaning for what it means in physics. It has nothing to do with quantum coherence. What it actually means is that it means that these measurement observables look very different from low rank operators. It means that their eigenvalues should be more or less uniform. And the way it's expressed is saying that the operator norm of each measurement matrix P is much smaller than its Frobenius norm. Okay? And so I'll come back to this a bit later, but this is sort of the key property that makes this work. And so Pauli matrices are an example of such incoherent matrices. Another familiar example is simply Gaussian random matrices. And again, you know, their eigenvalues have this semicircle distribution, and so they're spread out and they're incoherent. Now, the fact that these measurements are incoherent means that it means that this hyperplane is unlikely to be aligned with the faces of the trace norm ball. Sort of as a negative example, you can consider what happens if you choose these measurements to be say matrices that have a single one in one coordinate and all zeros everywhere else. And so in that case, it's a rank one matrix. It's obviously not incoherent. And it's obviously also not going to work for low rank matrix recovery, because if you simply measure matrix elements, then there are pathological examples where you'll never be able to reconstruct a low rank matrix. You know, for instance, if that unknown matrix itself has a single one in one position and all zeros everywhere else. Okay? So what I've said is not very rigorous, but I guess what I've done is just illustrate examples where the matrices are incoherent and I claim it works, and illustrate examples where they're not incoherent and it definitely doesn't work. Okay? So really there's more to it than that. But so the way these proofs work, though, is that you argue that for each row, when you choose a random hyperplane, then you're likely to have this geometric picture where there's a unique intersection between the trace norm ball and the hyperplane. And you know, and the way you formalize that is you want to show that any perturbation x away from this unknown state rho either changes the value of r of x, meaning it knocks you out of the hyperplane, or it increases the trace norm of x. Okay, and you can formalize this using something called the dual certificate, basically using convex duality. And the construction of that dual certificate is a randomized construction that takes advantage of this incoherence property. Okay? So,
is that definition exactly what you are giving us on plus epsilon on the right?
Sorry, what do you mean?
A little confused because I'm not sure I believe there are any non-constant employer.
But
I mean, not that aren't possible.
Oh, you mean that satisfy this inequality? Well, for instance, just tensor products of Pauli matrices will do it, no?
Okay.
So yeah, the signs of the eigenvalues can be positive or negative. And if you want, yeah, so if you want, you can relax this by a log factor, and that's actually okay too. Okay, so, yeah, so what I was describing was this sort of local picture of the geometry, but there's also this global picture, which is what you get with these universality results. And so this has to do with the restricted isometry property, and that's simply the following statement, that for all matrices X with dimension D and rank R, the sampling operator R obeys this inequality. So R of X in the vector 2 norm is approximately the same as X in the Frobenius norm, up to some multiplicative factor, you know, 1 minus delta or 1 plus delta. And delta you should think of as a constant. So this is saying that, you know, that these low rank matrices form some manifold, and that this manifold can be embedded into some linear space with small distortion. And so this by some standard result actually implies the ability to do all of these compressed sensing things, you know, using the trace minimization convex program. All of those things follow from this restricted isometry property. Okay, and so geometrically, this is my cheesy drawing of it. That you imagine that you have this manifold of pure states. So for a qubit, this would be the Bloch sphere, but in general, it's actually a much more complicated object. And so that's this blue object here, and it naturally lives in Euclidean space with dimension d squared, but we're projecting it into a subspace whose dimension is really only order d times a log factor. And the claim is that actually when you do this, this manifold doesn't get distorted very much. Okay? So yeah, this is kind of on the face of it a little bit surprising. And you know, and so there's some intuition again for why you can do this kind of embedding. And again, it comes down to this incoherence thing. So if you look at any low rank state and you decompose it in terms of Pauli operators, then the coefficients are not going to be too sharply peaked. You know, sort of the most extreme example is a stabilizer state where precisely d of those coefficients will be non-zero out of d squared total. But that's about as bad as it can get. And from this you would want to argue that because these coefficients are not sharply peaked, if you just sample a small random subset of them, you will roughly get the idea of what the state looks like. And the hard part is that it's not clear why this should be true uniformly for all quantum states simultaneously. And so this is really the work of the proof, to show that you can make this happen simultaneously for the entire manifold of states. So to do this, there's some technology which is, you know, which was really developed in compressed sensing. And so this uses something called an entropy argument. The intuition behind it is that Your first guess would be to just use the union bound, you know, show that for a given state rho, the probability of this claim failing is small, and now take the manifold of states, cover them with some discrete set of states rho, and sum up those failure probabilities and show that it's less than one. And if you do this, you find that you don't really get a good enough bound, but instead you can observe that that the success of this claim at two different points, say rho and rho prime, is actually correlated. Depending on how closely those two states are, the correlation will be stronger or weaker. And so it means that you can essentially consider a set of epsilon nets over the manifold of states with different scales, and then by summing over those different scales and summing and sort of adjusting for the different correlations between the events, you can now get a much better bound on the failure probability. And so that's what they mean by an entropy argument. They call it entropy because it's like it's sort of the numbers of points in these different epsilon nets that cover the trace norm ball correspond to, you can think of them as reflecting somehow the amount of information required to cover that set. Okay, so this is interesting because it's sort of a different picture of what's going on in compressed sensing. And this really has to do with the global structure of the state space, and it's really measured by these covering numbers, or entropy numbers as they're called. Okay? So that was sort of the conceptual picture of this talk, but let me show you some things which are a bit more concrete. So first, there are some specific things we get out of this universality result. One of them is stronger error bounds on reconstructing a low rank state using tomography. And in particular, we can get some bounds on the sample complexity of tomography. And then I'll talk about the proof ideas and some generalizations of this to other quantum systems. So here's this error bound that we can get. And so this is interesting because this actually applies to a full rank state rho, not a low rank one. And roughly speaking, the intuition is that if you do compressed tomography even when the state is not low rank, then you only have enough information to estimate order R times D parameters. And what you would really hope is that those order R times D parameters will correspond to the R leading eigenvectors of the density matrix. Okay? So we can't precisely prove that, but we can prove an error bound that is kind of consistent with this intuition. And so it says that you obtain an estimate sigma whose difference from rho in the two norm is bounded by this. And this is the difference between rho and the best rank R approximation to rho. So in other words, it's the weight of the tail of the eigenvalue spectrum. And so this is kind of encouraging because it says that if the eigenvalues of rho are rapidly decaying, then in fact the error of our compressed tomography estimate will also be decaying in a way that's not too much worse than that tail. Kind of in a flippant way, you could say that this is saying that it's almost as if we did the singular value decomposition and truncated, except that we did it without actually knowing most of the density matrix. But that's maybe not the most serious way of putting this. But this is kind of cool because this is a much better bound than we could get using these dual certificate methods. And sort of the reason is that with the dual certificate, as soon as anything deviates from the ideal, the dual certificate immediately becomes less effective. For instance, if the state rho is not really low rank, if it's full rank, then immediately it drops inside the trace norm ball somewhere. And so it's harder for the hyperplane to hit it. And likewise, as soon as there's noise in the measurement data, then this hyperplane, it gets perturbed in some way that again makes it harder to precisely hit the trace norm ball at one point. And having RIP gives you better control over these errors. Okay. And so the other thing we can get out of this is bounds on the sample complexity. So there are really two different things that you could measure with, well, there are more than two different things you could measure with tomography, but there are at least two. One of them is the number of measurement settings, and the other one is the number of copies of the unknown state. So early on, one concern that experimentalists had about compressed tomography was that although it was using fewer measurement settings, it could in fact require a lot more copies of the unknown state, just because it might turn out that you need to estimate these expectation values a lot more precisely now. And we couldn't really prove bounds that would remove this concern because we just didn't have good enough error bounds. But using RIP, you can actually get pretty good error bounds. So roughly speaking, they show that you need about d copies of the state for each expectation value that you measure. Okay, and in fact, this is about the same as if you were to just do something very simple like least squares fitting to do tomography. So in that sense, these compressed tomography methods don't require more samples per expectation value than you would need anyway, up to a constant factor. And so, so if you look at this paper, all of the people on it are theorists. And so, we talked a while with experimentalists to try to extract out of them a situation where compressed tomography would really have an advantage. We actually did come up with one. So in some of the ion trap experiments, it turns out that it actually is more time consuming to switch measurement settings than it is to simply repeat the same measurement over and over. And this, I think, is more due to the way the electronics and the controls are implemented. It's not really a fundamental physical thing. But at least in that situation, we could actually show that you can get an improvement from using compressed tomography just because using a few measurement settings allows you to repeat them many more times than you would be able to. So this is one example where this idea of using fewer measurement settings seems to pay off. But coming back to the more theoretical side, there's this picture that you can draw. This half of the table is what I showed you before. So this is for compressed tomography, and it's counting the numbers of parameters to be learned, which is order R times D, the number of Pauli operators which we measure, which is not much larger, up to a Pauli log factor, and the number of copies of the unknown state, which is about a factor of R times D larger. And this is kind of appealing because it agrees with some results that we also have in a different setting. So this is for fidelity estimation on the right side. And this is a simpler task where you just want to estimate the fidelity of the unknown state with a desired state. So you want to measure one parameter. And in this case, we can sort of get the same resource requirements, but scaled down by a factor of D. So the number of Pauli operators we need to do this is actually only order one, a constant. And the number of copies of the unknown state that we need is order D. Okay, so this is...
So by comparison, if you just do regular tomography, it's everything is D squared, or it's D squared Pauli log D?
So with regular tomography, it's D squared Pauli operators, and it's D cubed copies of the state. Maybe modulo some log factor, but I actually don't think there is one. Yeah, but it's basically d squared and d cubed. And so this, I don't know, this is kind of interesting because all of these methods on the table basically come about by choosing random Pauli measurements. So they turn out to be, I don't know, more useful than you would expect. Okay. Yeah, so let me show you some of the proof ideas. So the first thing is to show that that having this restricted isometry property implies the ability to do low rank matrix recovery. So this is sort of technical, but you know, but roughly speaking, the idea is that so that we're trying to recover some unknown state rho, we do it by, so I'm looking at the noiseless case. So in that case, then the convex program we solve is simply this. And in the case of quantum state tomography, you would also have a positive semi-definite constraint here. But in fact, these methods actually work without that constraint. Okay. And so we let S be the deviation between the solution X and the true state rho. And this, you know, and by design, we know that R of S is zero. Remember that R is the sampling operator. And so we want to show that this implies that S equals zero. And the way the proof works is to take S. So the first thing you can do is you can use the fact that this is a trace minimization program in an interesting way. So you can decompose S into two parts, S0 and SC. So S0 is a low rank piece, SC is the tail, and it's constructed in such a way that SC has zero overlap with the row and column spaces of the matrix row. Okay. And the point of this is that because X is the minimum trace solution and rho is low rank, you can show that the tail SC is actually bounded in trace norm by this low rank component S0. Okay? So this is one of the structural kind of features of this. And then on the other side of it, looking at SC, you can do something kind of interesting as well. So you can take SC, and again, you can decompose it just by taking blocks of consecutive singular values. And so to each of these blocks, you can apply this RIP condition, which says that the sampling operator R doesn't change the two norm of that block by very much. But you also have some algebraic thing that happens because the RIP condition is in the two norm, whereas some of these bounds that we have involve the trace norm. And so yeah, so I'm not going to go into this too much, but by combining these bounds, you can show that S equals zero. So this is a bit technical, but this is sort of the standard result that justifies why you can use RIP to get these compressed sensing results. And there are sort of progressively more elaborate versions of this technique, which gives you these stronger error bounds in the case where you have noisy data and full rank matrices and so on. Okay. So this is one half of it. The other half of it is showing that using Pauli measurements, the random sampling operator will in fact satisfy this RIP condition. Okay, and so you know, so there are a few previous results of this kind. So the first one using Gaussian random matrices is due to Recht from 2007, and this really did use just the plain union bound, the covering argument over the set of low rank states. And so this was very nice. And what we really do is to take this kind of argument and do a stronger bound which takes into account the correlations between failures on different low rank states. And so this is using some techniques due to Rudelson and Verscheinen, who had previously done this in sort of vector compressed sensing. And the new thing here is that we need a new bound on the covering numbers for the trace norm ball. And this actually turns out not to be so new, but it was known previously by Gridon et al. And this is done using some entropy duality technique, okay? So in a little more detail, first, let me show how you set up this problem in this, so that you can apply some probabilistic methods to it. So here R is this random Pauli sampling operator. And the RIP statement, you can kind of rephrase it like this. So you want to show that the operator R adjoint times R is close to the identity with respect to a certain norm called the R norm. And this R norm is defined here, and it comes by taking the supremum over all states X in a set U. Intuitively, these states X are low rank matrices, okay? The way they're defined in U is, well, yeah, so you can define them more or less like that, okay? But so in other words, you can rephrase this RIP claim as a claim about some random operator R star R, and its deviation from the mean, because it's not too hard to see that an expectation R star R will be the identity operator. You just want to show that it actually doesn't deviate much. And so because we chose Pauli, in this proof, we choose the Pauli matrices IID at random one by one. So R star R is going to be a sum of independent random variables. And so formally, this looks kind of like a standard thing. You have a sum of independent random variables, and you just want to show that they're close to the mean. And the trick is that you have this funny norm R coming in. Okay? So you want to do two things. You want to show that R star R minus one in this funny norm is going to be small in expectation, and then there are some more or less standard tail bounds that you can use to show that it's sharply concentrated. So proving this thing in expectation, I didn't write it on the slide, but it's the expectation of the R norm of R star R minus one. And the R norm involves this supremum. So it's bounding the expectation of a supremum of a set of random variables. And so there's some interesting machinery that is known for this. So in particular, Dudley's inequality gives this kind of bound for a special case where the random variables are Gaussian distributed. So they're not necessarily independent, but individually, and they're all Gaussians. Okay, and so Dudley's inequality tells, in that case, it gives us this bound. So we have a family of random variables g of x, for all x in some set u, and the expectation of their supremum is bounded by this integral. And so here n, these n are covering numbers. So each n of u dg epsilon is the number of balls of radius epsilon needed to cover the set u with respect to the metric dg. And dg is this metric that, again, sort of expresses the strength of correlations between different variables in this process. Okay, and so this integral is integrating over different scales. So this formally expresses this multi-scale entropy argument. Okay, and so this reduces the problem to bounding these covering numbers. So you can do some more technical steps, that simplify this problem. But in the end, it boils down to bounding this covering number. So the set U in this, you can replace it in this case with the trace norm ball U1. And this metric D sub G, it turns out that you can bound it conveniently by something called the X norm. and it's, so it's the maximum inner product between a matrix and any one of the Pauli observables. Okay. And so there are two bounds on this. The first one is sort of a trivial one. So this, well, trivial after, you know, after using some more simple algebra on the X norm. And this is exponential in D squared, which is sort of what you would expect because we're dealing with D squared dimensional objects, matrices. But it's polynomial in 1 over epsilon, which means that it's, so it's not too bad as epsilon gets small. Now, there's this other more clever bound, and this is the one that took some work to prove. This thing is actually quite surprising because it's only quasi-polynomial in the dimension D. But it only really works well when epsilon is fairly large because the dependence on 1 over epsilon is kind of nasty. But so this is sort of saying that the trace norm ball, if you squint a little and only look at it at relatively coarse scales, it's actually smaller than you might expect, you know, for the purposes of this problem, I guess. That it's not really, it doesn't behave exactly as a D squared dimensional thing would, okay? And so it's the combination of these two bounds that gives us the result. And the way to get the clever bound is using entropy duality. So entropy duality is a way of relating one covering number to what's called the dual covering number, which is sort of defined by taking for each norm, you take the dual norm and you have covering and using this adjoint mapping. So it's kind of involved, but this entropy duality is basically a tool that allows us to replace one covering number with another one. And this, what we get out of it turns out to be much easier to bound. And it's something that we can do using sort of known techniques. Okay. So that's all I'm going to say about the proof. But in some sense, all these techniques basically are what you use to formalize this geometric picture of what's happening in the trace norm ball. Okay. So let me finish up with something a lot easier. So in some more recent work, I and collaborators have looked at applying these methods to continuous variable systems. So really the goal was to see what different kinds of measurements we could use that would allow us to do compressed tomography. So first, there's one way that you can generalize this approach. And so remember that with Pauli operators, it was very simple because the Pauli operators are an orthonormal basis. So it turns out that many of those arguments will also go through using what's called a tight frame. And so this is a collection of observables, WA indexed by A, that satisfy this identity. So when A is sampled from some measure mu, then for all rho, you know, you can decompose rho into its coefficients with respect to WA, and then sum up again, and you recover rho. Okay, so like examples of tight frames are the set of coherent states or the set of displacement operators. They all satisfy identities of this kind. So it turns out that again. If these observables WA satisfy some incoherence condition, which is that the operator norm is of order 1, then many of these compressed sensing results just go right through. So one thing I should point out is that it's the way these WA have to be normalized now is it's really the normalization is implicit in this probability measure d mu. Okay. The integral of d mu of A has to sum to 1. So that's the condition that forces a certain normalization on all of these. Okay. And so, you know, so we actually have a new theoretical proposal for how you could do compressed sensing for a continuous variable system. So this is for a state of n photons with a single mode. And what we're suggesting is that you choose these WA to be weighted displacement operators. So when I say weighted, it's because I'm assuming that the index A is sampled from a certain distribution, which is the Gaussian of width square root of n, roughly. And so it's not hard to see that the displacement operators form a tight frame. The neat thing is that when you sample them and weight them this way, they actually are incoherent. And sort of the reason is that, to begin with, by themselves, the displacement operators are unitary if you didn't weight them. But also, if you don't weight them, then this measure mu is not a probability measure. It doesn't sum to one. So in order to make mu a probability measure, you have to do this weighting. So when you do this weighting, the displacement operators become unbounded. But it turns out that all of the large norm behavior occurs at high energy states, which you truncate out because you're only worried about n photon states. So within the n photon subspace, these things are actually incoherent. They have small operator norm. And so this, I don't know, this is sort of a complicated way of saying that if you only have n photons, then the expected energy of the system can't be too large. And so you shouldn't need to look at very large displacements. But but that intuition basically is precise, can be made precise. Okay. And so this means that by estimating expectation values of displacement operators, you can do compressed tomography. And the last piece of the puzzle is to show that using homodyne measurements, you can actually estimate these expectation values. And it's sort of using some algebra, but it's basically by using the fact that the characteristic function is the Fourier transform of the Wigner function. And so this is something that you can estimate fairly easily just using homodyning. So on the face of it, this looks pretty cool. You know, it has all of these nice theoretical bounds, and at least from a theoretical point of view, it uses a detector that exists in the lab. I guess the big question about this proposal is this really a good way of using a homodyne detector? Because in a way, this is also throwing away some of the information that comes out of homodyning, because from the homodyne detector, you can really sample this marginal of the Wigner function. And we're using that ability merely to estimate a single Fourier coefficient rather than keeping the whole distribution. So in that sense, it seems a little wasteful. I and others went through this whole argument also earlier on with Pauli expectation values, you know, arguing that just estimating a Pauli expectation value was not the best use of your device when your device can actually measure each individual qubit in one of the three Pauli eigenbases. I don't really know the answer to that question, but at least this is one way that you could do compressed tomography for a system that, you know, that we really didn't know how to apply it to before. Just a few practical issues. So, you know, there are actually some different estimators that you can use with compressed tomography. The one I've been showing you is this trace minimization estimator. There's a related one called the Danzig selector, which uses something a little fancy in this over here. And this one is actually, it gives you better theoretical bounds on the error than this. So the So the lasso seems to do quite well in practice, and this is just a form of regularized least squares estimation. Now there's one that I don't really know of theoretical results for, but it seems natural enough. So this is regularized maximum likelihood estimation. And yeah, it would be nice to understand better how that does. So it would be nice to also have better algorithms for solving these convex programs. So standard SDP solvers do pretty well for relatively small dimensions, like up to 100 or so. But to do larger than that, you need more specialized algorithms. There's been quite a bit of progress on this, though, recently. So I guess we are getting there. And yeah, I guess the last thing I have in mind is just to ask whether any of these methods can be used for anything else. You know, are there, in particular, are there different tasks that you can use, that you can accomplish using these compressed sensing techniques? And are there different motivations for doing it, really? You know, for instance, from talking to the experimentalists, one surprising thing they told us is that actually sometimes a big obstacle can be just the classical post-processing of the data. And so even if you can do D squared measurements on a quantum device, just because everything is happening so quickly on the device, it still can be a lot of data to try to fit afterwards. And so in that sense, that might be an unconventional or unexpected advantage of compressed sensing, that you have data that can be more easily summarized to do the classical post-processing. Coming back to other applications, so there are, in the classical world, there are some surprising applications of these compressed sensing ideas. So some of the same arguments have been used for things like graph clustering or super resolution imaging, sort of reconstructing features that are beyond the resolution of the spatial resolution of a detector. And so that, these all come from unconventional uses of these ideas. And so I'm curious whether some of that might be possible here too. And I think that's it. So thanks.
Sure, you have questions for Itai. If you don't, I have a question. So it seems like every lab should implement compressed tomography in a traditional way. So I was wondering how is this received in the experimental community?
I think it was received well. I think the reason that it's not so widely used is that it really works better for, say, 6 to 8 qubits or more, because all of these things really give an advantage only when you have sort of enough qubits that you can see the difference between the scaling of this and some more conventional method. And so there aren't really that many experiments that are actually in that regime that really need this. I think what a lot of people have said is that they really want to do process tomography. That in some ways is, first, it's more demanding than state tomography just because everything is twice as big. But in some ways it's also sort of more interesting from an experimental point of view. There are more things to discover there. And so I think, all of these methods can be used for process tomography. So I think that's probably where it's likely to happen, but it hasn't happened yet. I don't think anyone has written a paper on it. I think people are interested, but it will probably turn out that it ends up being used for process tomography, and then it will be in kind of in conjunction with some other interesting work that motivates the need to do a new experiment. I guess that's how I would put it. Yeah.
So you still have this random choice of polys that then you use for every state.
Yeah.
But do you know if that random choice can be de-randomized?
As far as I know, there are no results on de-randomizing this. I think for vector compressed sensing, there are some deterministic constructions, but the parameters are a lot worse than the randomized ones. So I think it's a hard problem. I think there's some relatively recent paper by Bourguin and several others which makes some progress on this, but it seems pretty hard. Yeah.
Along similar directions, do you know if sampling these polys in a slightly different way will give you better features of tomography?
I don't know of any rigorous results of that type, but yeah, but I mean it would be sort of an attractive thing to maybe sample some of the polys with different probabilities depending on their weight, for instance. You know, if you were more concerned about, say, local correlations within the state, or like estimating the local density matrices, then it might make more sense to sample those. So I don't know. So I haven't really thought much about it, but it's probably a good idea. Or there are probably situations in which it's a good idea.
If there are no more questions, let's thank Yikai for answering these questions and giving this very nice talk again.